It's time for FLA Law, brought to you by the personal injury attorneys of Peronic, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyes. This hour will be informative, along with taking your questions and comments. Now, here are your hosts for today's show.
Good evening. This is Attorney Matthew Noyce, and I am one of the attorneys at Peronic, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyce, the longest established personal injury attorney firm in Tampa Bay. We have been serving those injured by the faults of others since 1955. We were started by Guy Peronic, and ever since then, we've kept the motto of being a voice for the injured. And so if you have questions tonight regarding personal injury, car accidents, workers' compensation, or even Social Security disability, I'm here to answer those questions. But I'm not alone, and that's not the only area of law that we have to talk about. I am blessed to have a friend and a colleague, Patrick Gaffney, here to also be here to answer questions that you have. So if you have questions regarding the law, this is the hour to call. You have two attorneys here. The number is 727-441-3000. Oftentimes, the calls come in near the end of the show, and we can't take all of them. So if you have a question, I would encourage you to call now, and so you can get your question on the air, and we can get it answered for you. Now, you may not want your voice on the radio, and so there's other means to watch it, and it is through our Facebook page. The Facebook page is Peronic, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyce Injury Lawyers, and we are live now, and you can see us in action. But you can also send questions that you may have just through Facebook, and I'm looking at it right here, and I'll be able to address your questions there. So give us a call at 441-3000 or jump on Facebook at Peronic, Caulfield, Averill, and Noyce Injury Lawyers. And we're here for the next 52 minutes to answer your question. So, Patrick, thank you very much for taking an hour out of your time to serve the community by answering questions.
Matt, it's my pleasure. And, you know, our offices are not far from each other. I'm on Sunset Point. You're around the corner on Belcher.
I know. It's great.
We don't see each other that often. We'll have to, you know, get some lunch or something.
I know. Yeah, we've known each other for a long time.
It's been a good time.
So, as we told our listeners, I do personal injury, but you do a whole other area of law that I welcome your expertise, because I cannot give any expertise in your area of law. So why don't you tell our listeners, what area of law do you specialize in, and what kind of questions are you here to answer?
Well, Matt, thank you. You know, it's been my privilege now to practice law since 1983. I started my career at the state attorney's office then. Was James T. Russell was the state attorney, and yeah. Bernie McCabe was one of his assistants. Now Bernie has passed away because he was the state attorney for a long time. And his assistant was Bruce Bartlett, who's now the state attorney. So I go back to my state attorney days. And when I came out of the state attorney's office, I began working for a firm called Peacock and Cope, both of which are blessed memory at this time. It just turns out that, like, I think it's 17 years ago yesterday, Mr. Peacock passed away, and Charles Cope, who had later become after he worked in the firm, became a judge, he passed away sometime before that. So what I've been doing since my leaving of the state attorney's office is started to be general practice, but now is family law, and I've been board certified by the Florida Bar since 1995. In the field of family law, and what that entails is divorce law and all its aspects, including dealing with children, dealing with property, dealing with support. There are paternity cases where people are not married, and I just point out that in my practice I'm seeing an increasing number of family law matters that seem to come about in a paternity setting. I don't think people are getting as married as much as they were, say, in the past. And of course, my practice also entails some wills, trust, and that sort of thing.
Sure. Sure. Now, you say that you are a board certified now, gosh, for almost 30 years now,
yeah,
right?
Coming up on 30 years.
Yeah. Our faithful listeners know what board certified civil trial attorney means, because we have two lawyers in our firm that are board certified civil trial attorneys. But board certified in marital and family law. Not all family law attorneys are board certified, right?
That's right. I mean, you got to pass the Florida bar, which in and itself can be a challenge. 3 years of law school, and 4 years of undergrad. And then if you wish to be, you know, board certified, you have to go through additional hoops that you have to jump over, including getting recommendations from lawyers and judges and taking a test and passing it. And then you get the wonderful privilege of being board certified.
And you have to renew it to continue to show your expertise.
That's right. Every 5 years, you have to renew your board certification by, again, getting additional recommendations. Judges get to comment on it. But you don't have to take the test again. But you do have
Thank goodness.
You do have to keep on your continuing legal education.
Yes. Well, good. And I think there's only about 2% of all the lawyers are board certified.
Yeah, that's what I'm told.
In the state of Florida.
I know, I'll say this, I know a lot of great lawyers that are not board certified, but I think it doesn't hurt to be board certified.
Sure.
And in fact, it kind of gives the public at least a way of saying this person has met a certain criteria. They know what perhaps they're doing.
Yeah, no, I think that's a wonderful thing. So if you have questions for a board certified marital and family law specialist, give us a call, 441-3000. But Patrick, you specialize in marital law. What inspired you to do that? Isn't that a depressing area? And we deal with injuries, and so we have physical injuries we have to deal with. But you have, in marital law and family law, there's a lot of mental injuries and other depressing situations. What inspires you to do what you do?
I think that's a very good question, Matt. And it's interesting because I've had the same legal assistant, Denise Holmes, for 23 years, and we sometimes sit together, why do we do this? Because you get a lot of drama, you get everyone's problems. But of course, life is problems, and you don't avoid them by not looking at them. And
right.
I find it, I guess there's a way of finding some kind of fascination, interest, seeing this is what you're meant to do, and just listening to people's stories and trying to help them out of the problems that they find themselves in. My mother, who passed away about 10 years ago, used to tell me, you know, the greatest honor that a person can have, or the highest calling, is to help other people solve their problems. And so I've tried to look at it that way. I've been fascinated by the field of family law. I'd say not all people are drawn to it for the reason I am. I think there are some people that are drawn to it for the idea they're going to make a lot of money doing it, or something like that. I don't think that's a good path. As we were talking off air prior to this, it's like if you're in it for the money, you're not in the right place.
Right.
You need to share this with you because you've shared it with me, is that we're in this to try to help people. And that's not something we just say on the radio. It's something we're saying privately between each other,
sure.
Which is, hey, look, life is short. How do you spend it? And you try to spend it meaningfully by helping people. And then if you do that, you know, you'll make a living doing it.
Right.
That's what we try to do.
Your mother had that saying for you. My mom also, who's passed away, had a saying. She said, your goal is to make the world a better place for one person in your life every day. And so that gives us, I think, as being lawyers, we have that opportunity to try to help somebody every day, whether it's personal injury or even in family law.
Well, you know, as we're coming up on Mother's Day, it just so happens this coming weekend, it's amazing how much it appears to both of us and our mothers have affected our
sure.
lives. And I'll say that, you know, I know you have started a family foundation that was inspired by your mom, and your whole family is kept together by her memory, which I think is fantastic. And I had a great mother, too. She's still with me a lot. She had a lot of good sayings. One of the sayings that I repeat to my clients when they call me in a very disturbed manner is, this will pass.
Yeah.
All things pass, and this will pass too. And it's true. I mean, over time, everything's impermanent. It's going to pass. But some of those things just stick with you. Another one was, and my mother was a church organist in a Catholic church.
Oh, okay.
And she used to listen to the homilies, and she would tell us, blessed are the peacemakers. And so, to the extent possible, I try to be a problem solver, not disturber. Try to be a peacemaker.
Right.
A way to live life.
Well, and that's what I wanted to talk about. I mean, when people think about a divorce lawyer, I've known you for a long time, and you certainly aren't the stereotypical ruthless, win at all cost, you know, scorch the earth kind of family law.
Or try not to be.
Try not to be. But just like in personal injury law, I mean, the goal is ultimately to reach a resolution that's best for the client. But how do you accomplish that without having to be cutthroat and ruthless?
Well, it's interesting because people have perceptions of what law is, what lawyers are, what divorce lawyers are. And many
or ambulance chasers like us, personal
right,
injury
and
attorneys.
And as we know, once you're inside the bubble, it's a lot different than it appears from the outside. I try to do with people is sit down and, first of all, be very transparently honest with them. I have no airs about it, but you know, most people who want to go out there and be very aggressive, it's very expensive to hire lawyers. In my field, it's hourly rate. I know contingency,
right.
But you know, my hourly rate, I think it's $450 an hour. It doesn't take long to burn up a lot of money if we're going to litigate. So that's one of the conversations I have with a, I can see by who you are, what you do, and what you have, that, you know, you've done well in life, but nobody wants to spend their life savings on a divorce. Let's talk about how we solve this problem. And realizing, based on choices that you make, you can either spend a lot or not as much, but the concept, and this is something that, you know, it's something I believe in, is the concept of what's a reasonable compromise. You're not going to get 100% of what you think you want. Because
right.
What you think you want is probably not, you know, correct thinking anyway. What you're going to get is something that is, and you're typically, if there's going to be children, you also got to raise children together after this thing happens. So do you want to scorch the earth? Do you want to make an enemy? Do you want to make this divorce a cloud that carries over your head for the rest of your life? Most people would say no. Some people are not that well informed or not that, they're not thinking right. And I try to help them, and I do recommend to them to get mental health counseling. It's not something that I think is a taboo. I think it's something a lot of people could benefit from to kind of sort out, get that emotion stuff sorted out in counseling. Let's talk about practical resolution when we're in the divorce. Let's not spend a bunch of money you don't have.
Right.
And I have that conversation very often in my office.
Yeah, it's transparency. It's also acting in good faith, both with your client, but I think it's also important that we work in good faith with the other side. I always tell my clients, listen, they're going to find out anyhow. Let's just be transparent. Let's work on a handshake. And if they bite our hand, we know. And I think you and I have a similar philosophy, too. And I saw it on one of your bios. Walk softly and carry a big stick.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
You know, what clients may not understand is that if you can get along with the opposing lawyer, you know, they somehow have watched enough television where you're not supposed to do that. But in fact, as you know, it goes so much better for the client. We're not in a personal animosity with the other lawyer.
Right.
That just burns up money, and it's negative energy. And if you're ever in front of a judge and he catches wind that you're acting that way towards each other, it doesn't go well for the lawyers either. The
right.
Lawyer wants, the lawyers, the judges, they should act in a appropriate professional ways, benefits the clients. We do have a system. You know, we have a system that's been around for a long time. We got it from England before we took it over, and it works. One of the things they had in England is ends of court, and we have a vestige of that coming over to the United States. The whole idea of ends of court has been you sit down with the other lawyers, you get to know them, and you know something, when you've broken bread with another lawyer, it's very hard to act mean towards that lawyer.
I agree.
I think it's a good thing. So that's something that where public perception does not always meet reality.
Right. No. And it's always in the best interest of the client. You know, it's good to get along, fight when you need to fight, because it really builds credibility for those things that you really have to fight about, instead of just fighting just for the principle of fighting.
Right. And so you don't make it personal.
Right.
You fight over an issue. I mean, you advocate. Sometimes lawyers can get over the top. Sometimes it's appropriate to be a zealous advocate for your client. But it never should cross the line where you're taking a personal shot at either the other lawyer or the other party. You always want to be respectful to the court. I mean, there's been reported decisions where the judge gets angry at someone because of the way they're treating not just the parties, but the judge, him or herself. So, you know, it's an interesting area. I must say now, after about 40 years of practicing it, it has been a fascinating area, and I don't think I would have chosen another field. I would tell anyone who's thinking of getting into it, hey, if you want to help people, you want to live a life of interest where you get to hear a lot of stories of what people get themselves into, well, law generally, and family law particularly, you get to hear some things you don't hear on television.
And no day is the same.
That's true.
Every day is a little bit different. And that's what I enjoy about being a lawyer, is that it's not going to the same job, clocking in at the time clock, doing A, B, C, and then probably D, E, F, right, and then punching out and being done, and then going back the next day and doing those A, B, C, Ds all over again.
Well, it's also, if you're interested in the human condition, like in your work, you deal with people that have been injured. Some people have been very compromised, but to hear the story of their life and how this injury has affected their life, what their life was before, now, and after, I mean, that's got to be a very, you probably could write a book, as I could. Yeah. I have people that come into me and they tell me their story of their life and how this marriage didn't work and how we need to get to a place where you can be happy again. I never encourage divorce. I stay on the side of, hey, if I can help you, let me help you, but I'm not going to encourage you to get divorced. Go to a counselor, go to your minister, go to someplace and figure out for yourself what's in your best interest. When you've decided that it's in your best interest, that you can no longer stay in this relationship and have it healthy and happy for you and your children, then I can help you. I'm sure in your work, you must run into people who they wish they had their old life back.
Sure.
They wish they had, you know, the ability to do the things they used to do, and now they're compromised because of their injury. And sometimes you really respect these people, how they live their lives. I mean, it takes a lot of dignity to live a life that's compromised and not give in to it.
Right. It's a new normal for them when they didn't want it. And so I admire people that can adjust to that new normal and not feel like they're walking around with a big dark cloud over their head because somebody crashed into them or some other kind of neglect.
Well, so, you know, one of the things about having kids is that I've got two great kids, and they, you know, they teach you not, the world's not just about you.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember as a younger person before kids, you know, I thought the world revolved around me, but it doesn't. It revolves, you know, in a different way, and we have to see our place. And sometimes we find people that are better adept at accepting a more humble way of life. They're not going to get what they thought they were going to get, but what they have is enough, which leads me to my philosophy of always being grateful,
right,
because things can always be worse.
Right, that's for sure. That's for sure, you know, and that philosophy is what I admire about you.
And I think you have the same philosophy.
And well, I don't do family law, so
no, but
you know, you have that philosophy in an area of law that you do. I mean, it just benefits the client so much, and so I admire you for having that philosophy. But let's go and let's talk about family law and divorces. You know.
Sure.
What some of our listeners may not even understand the process of a divorce. But before we get into the process, what, in your experience, is the number one or the top three reasons why people get divorced?
Well, you know, it spans a lot of different areas, but I'll tell you, addiction, people that are married to people that are alcoholics, drug addicts, it's just not very easy to be. It may not be possible to be married to someone, because as I understand addiction, it's basically a very self-centered way to live, and it's all about the addiction. It's not about these other people in your lives. And of course, there's organizations like Al-Anon who help people to try to deal with that, but I see addiction as being a very big issue. I also see sort of our culture is all very much focused on me. It's all about me. And I don't know that that's good in a family. Eventually, if you're going to have a successful marriage and a successful family, you've got to give up me. It has to become about us. It has to be about the family. It's got to be something that's larger than yourself that you are serving. And, you know, in today's culture, I think there's just a lot of people that are misguided. They are looking out for what's best for them, and they do not see the value that of giving up your ego for something larger. And you can take all kinds of specific circumstances where this happens. People make mistakes too, and you know, it's hard for people to forgive. You know, and even if you can forgive someone, you can't always go back into that relationship. So, you know, divorce is kind of an interesting area because you see all of this. You see where, hey, people love each other, but they can't be married anymore because of things that have happened. It's like a bell that you can't unring. Some bad behavior, you know, people stray out of their marriage. It's not always easy or possible to put it back. So I think, again, coming back to living a life of honesty and transparency benefits someone in so many areas of life, but certainly in the area of your personal family life. Sure. If you can try to aspire to that, you won't have these problems. But, you know, over half the people who get married get divorced, and it's a stunning...
Is that still the percentage?
That's what I understand, and it's a stunning statistic.
Well, let's talk about divorce. What happens when a couple gets to that situation where they just can't stay together anymore? What's the initial process? What do they have to go through?
Well, I mean, I would recommend anyone that's having those kind of problems to go get some marriage counseling. Now, marriage counseling, like all kinds of counseling, doesn't always work to achieve the end to which you went there for. It doesn't always put the marriage back together. But then the people can branch into their individual counseling and work on the things that are causing problems in their relationship. But when they get to a point where this marriage can't be put back together, they typically go see an attorney, and an attorney would start the process. Now, it's interesting, in the last decade or so, what has become more popular is something called collaborative divorce, like all kinds of collaborative law, and there's even statutes that have been adopted in Florida about it. But basically, and I'm a member of a collaborative law group where, as opposed to filing for divorce in the legal system, serving your spouse with process, lawyering up, so to speak, and going through the disclosure process, the mediation process, and if that doesn't work, the trial process, it's possible for two lawyers who are collaboratively trained to link together with a psychologist or mental health person and typically a forensic accountant and work together as a team to try to resolve cases. And I've done this successfully in many cases where there are big dollar cases, companies that have to be valued, where it would just be enormously expensive to do this through the litigation process, very inefficient, lead to bad feelings between the parties, where we've been able to resolve major conflict through collaborative law. Now, the unique aspect of truly collaborative law is that you have to sign a contract that says if we don't settle this case through using our attorneys that we've hired to go through the process, those attorneys agree to withdraw from further representation. If we actually then have to enter the court system, we have to do that with new lawyers.
Oh, okay.
So the intention there is to get the incentive to make money out of the lawyer's, you know, mind. We're not here to, you know, take all their money or to have an incentive to push them to trial to make more money. It's more of, let's, you know, you're going to invest in this process, let's complete the process and not be wasteful by having to hire new lawyers. So to answer your question in kind of a long way, you explore counseling, you explore collaborative law. That doesn't work. Those collaborative law doesn't work for everyone, because you have to agree up front you're going to be transparent. And some people don't want to be transparent,
right,
or they're not comfortable with the idea that they have to fire their lawyers. So you go through a more traditional process, which I was referring to, where you hire a lawyer, file a petition. You have to complete something called mandatory disclosure, which includes a financial affidavit, tax returns. It includes things like your checking accounts and credit cards, all of which has to be shared. Once your spouse is served, they have to produce all of that within a period of time, typically 45 days. And then you're going to be required by the circuit judges to go to mediation. And I also do a fair amount of mediation as a mediator. So the mediation process is, in every case, in every county around here, before you ever get in front of a judge on a trial, you're going to have gone through mediation.
Okay. I was going to ask you that question, because we have that in personal injury. It's before you can get a trial, you need to have mediation. So mediation in family law.
Very prevalent.
Okay.
And it can be very good for the parties. I think what most lawyers who do a lot of this work kind of figure, hey, listen, you're going to pay me a retainer, and that's going to get you through mediation. And if you have to go beyond mediation, you're going to have to pay more money, and probably money you can't afford, because, you know, you're looking at people that, you know, even that both of them are working and they're making good incomes and they're, you know, paying for their mortgage and they're trying to put their kids through college and things like that. They can't afford a $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 expense.
Sure.
It's just going to be too much of a burden. So mediation then becomes even more important, because even though you have differences, you try to find a way to meet in the middle so that you can avoid spending your wealth.
That's good. And in our area, if we can't settle the case in mediation, we end up going to a trial. We have jury trials in personal injury. Family law?
Well, you know, I've heard of some issues in family law being tried before a jury. I mean, in my previous life as a prosecutor, tried a lot of cases in front of juries. All family law cases that I'm involved in, unless they have a personal injury element to it or a element to it that would include the right to a jury, you're going to try it in front of a judge.
Yes.
So knowing your judge,
yes,
and knowing their preferences, you know, this is the thing about family law that becomes very, you know, localized. You know, if you were in front of a judge you're not used to practicing in front of, you're not quite sure how they feel about certain things. So it's important to know your judge and I think in Pinellas County particularly, we have a great set of family law judges. I'm not just saying that. I just think they're really good at what they do. And you'll get a fair shake in front of them. They'll listen to what you have to say. But going to trial requires preparation. Preparation costs money.
Right.
Because you're going to spend about twice as much time preparing as you actually are going to be trying your case. And that is putting together evidence books, putting together financial documents, and typically having an expert. If you're going to spend that kind of money on a trial, you're going to have a forensic accountant. You might have a guardian ad litem. There's a number of experts that we use in family law. Those are two of them. The guardian ad litem is used to speak to children and to relate to the court what they feel is in the best interest of children. But there's also, for example, a type of expert that's used very commonly in support cases called a vocational rehabilitation expert. So by way of example, say someone is not working. So we have a long-term marriage, you know, in excess of 20 years, and the wife doesn't work and the husband's got a great job, but if it's an alimony case, we have to determine what the wife could do, because she has to earn something commensurate with her ability to work. And we typically, in that kind of a scenario, would consider retaining an expert to determine what can the wife do. Or can the wife, it could be a husband, we've had those kind of situations, whatever the spouse that is seeking support would need to do to get themselves rehabilitated, whether that is going to college or technical school, so they can earn as much money. So the money they can earn counts to support them, and it means less spousal support for that.
Okay. So I know when I think about family law or divorce law, there's really three things. There's alimony, child custody, and child support. So I know there's far more than that.
Let me put it this way. You're getting very close to where you are, which is first is child issues. So we call that's one bucket of issues.
Okay.
And we have something in Florida called the Florida Parenting Plan. So this started several years ago when actually we sort of memorialized the party's understanding with regard to children, how they're going to co-parent their children in a document called a parenting plan. And the most important part of the parenting plan is how they're going to do time sharing.
Yeah, and law recently changed on that, right?
So last July, there was a law that was passed that had previously been touted to be passed for a very long period of time to try to get equal time sharing between parents to be presumed. And in every other legislative session, I'm saying going back maybe 10 years or more, it's been shot down because it always included some other element to the law that the governor at that time would veto. Well, that didn't happen last year. Last year, the law was passed that there is now a presumption of equal time sharing. And so that's meant to be passed to help people solve their problems about, well, I don't think you should have as much time as I should have, or you should have this time and I should have this that much time. And, you know, you can imagine people going through a difficult emotional divorce may have disagreements about how much time they should spend with children. So the law was meant, and I think to some extent has, in my experience anyway, helped people come to a resolution. It's only a presumption. That is to say, in the right...
I was going to ask you that.
Right. So under the right circumstance, you can have something other than equal time sharing. But it's you've got to overcome the presumption. So if there's been abuse, or if there has been addiction, or if there has been any number of factual circumstances that would not lead one to believe that equal time sharing is in the child's best interest, that can still be brought up.
Okay.
And you know, there's some professions like firemen and police officers and others, they have unique schedules where they're working in the middle of the night, and it's hard to do equal time sharing when you have those kind of schedules. So, you know, what we do in mediation is we try to be creative in fashioning parenting plans so that the thing that the psychologists tell us is that it's important for every child to have a positive relationship with both parents. So we have to be mindful, and one of the things the judges are very good at telling everyone is, hey, listen, you have to encourage a relationship between the child and the other parent. That is very key to co-parenting. And it's the opposite of something that's referred to as parental alienation, which is when you would alienate a child from the other parent, which is commonly seen in family law. It's kind of a natural, yes, unfortunate dark side of some people's way of dealing with family issues, is to try to either overtly or not so overtly kind of turn the child against the other parent, which we should not obviously be encouraging.
And that could be grounds for rebutting that presumption.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Of 50-50.
You wouldn't want to have someone who is alienating a child having significant time with that child without getting counseling. So we try to, if we can, we try to help people. Someone who's maybe just not enlightened, someone who's ignorant, someone who needs more education, someone who needs some counseling. Counseling doesn't always work, but if you haven't done it, you should try it.
That's true. And I'm going to forget to let our listeners know that we are live, and if they have questions, they can call us at 727-441-3000. We lawyers can talk forever, and we kind of know what the questions are going to be as well, so I think we can kind of address the questions that we think our listeners have. But we still encourage them that if they have a specific question to give us a call.
Sure.
441-3000. So that child custody or time sharing, that's one aspect
of the issues that we deal with, and it's in many instances when you have minor children the most important. It trumps just about everything else. But once we pass that, because some people can come rather readily to an understanding, oh, you're just going to do it 50-50, no problem. That happens. Then we have to deal with the what we call equitable distribution, which is we look at the date of marriage and we look at the date of filing of the divorce. That period of time is the period of time of the marriage. And during that period of time, the parties that have accumulated assets or debts, that's considered the marital estate. And the general rule would be that you take the marital estate and you divide it in half, and each party gets one half of it. And in practicality, you got to deal with some other issues. For example, a house. Now, people may know that values, particularly in the Pinellas County, west coast of Florida area, have gone up, and interest rates have gone up as well. So when parties divorce, there comes an issue. What are we going to do with the house? We could sell it. Or we could, one of us could buy the other one out of it. The problem with buying your spouse out of the equity in the home is interest rates have gone up and the equity in your home has gone up, which means you're going to have to pay your spouse one half of the equity, which is the market value minus the mortgage balance. And one half of that has to be financed typically. So you go to a financial institution and you realize that your 2-3% mortgage is now a 7% mortgage,
right.
And you're increasing your mortgage balance by hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you figure out you can't afford to do it. That we see that a lot.
Mm.
So that's a practical part of how you divide things into. You sell the house, you have to agree on a realtor, you have to agree on a price, you got to make the house available. That's typical. The next biggest, or one of the next biggest issues in equitable distribution of assets, Matthew, is retirement. So you work at a job and you gain a 401k. So that period of time from date of marriage to date of filing occurs and applies to all assets, which include retirement assets. So what do you do with retirement assets? Well, you see what each party has as of date of filing of the divorce, and if there's an inequality, you equalize them. And you equalize them by means of a document, an order that's typically prepared by a special attorney, not your divorce attorney. It's called a qualified domestic relations order.
Wow.
And through a qualified domestic relations order, you can transfer from one party's 401k to another party's 401k to make it equal. But you have to go through a process to do it. People don't always get that, but it's part of the Internal Revenue Code.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
It's
Oh, great. All right. So I think that's very interesting. It requires another thing.
Yep.
But we do have Denise on the line. Denise, thank you for calling in. How can we help you tonight?
Yes, hi. I got a question for you.
Sure.
I had a divorce my spouse in 2001, and he was paying me child support from 2001 to 2004. I had a child in 2005, and he made false allegations against me and turned the child support around, and I had to go through all kinds of courts, all kinds of expenses, and there was nothing that we weren't fighting over property or anything. So he was very abusive and controlling. And he was a drug addict. He knew how to manipulate the court system, and he got custody of my son at that time. I was a lot younger. I didn't have any money to fight him back. So now, all these years later, my son's 26. They live in California, and he's trying to fight me for back child support and sue me for $45,000 and lawyer's fees. And I want to know, what grounds can I help myself with against this lawsuit that he's coming against me with?
And I'm sorry you're going through what you're going through.
Thank you.
And Denise, can you turn your radio down just a little bit, because we have a little bit of feedback, okay?
Yeah, okay.
So, again, Patrick and I are sorry we're going through this. I don't think we can give you specific information, but I think Patrick can give you general information about situations you need to think about going through this process. Patrick.
All right, okay. So one question for you, ma'am. Is this thing that your former husband is doing to you, is it happening in California or here in Florida?
Well, actually, I think because he is addicted to meth and actually pain pills, my son said so, is that when I went to some mediation yesterday, my son was his power of attorney, and he's not old at all either. So that was a surprise to me, because there's something going on with him.
Was the divorce filed in Florida?
Yes, the divorce was filed in Florida, and I had text messages, because it's really not my ex, I believe. I believe it's my son, that he wants the money, and I never had a relationship. My ex-husband didn't let me see him barely at all with him growing up. I wanted to co-parent. I wanted to get along with him, so that would be for the best case for my son.
Right.
And he didn't work together with me.
Well, let me just say this. This is a very good example of why family law is fascinating. I mean, it sounds like you could write a book about this experience. Now,
you're right.
Now, so what I would say to you is don't fall into despair. The story's not over. But if there is a court order that required you to pay child support that you did not pay, well, then there's a basis for him to seek child support from you. Is that what happened?
Well, he made false. He was paying me, and he didn't want to pay me. He made false allegations, and at that time, I could have probably have overturned it, but I ran out of money. I didn't have money to overturn it, and now I'm faced with fees that he, because of him overturning it, and he knew he was a person that is criminal minded. He knows how to manipulate the system.
So Denise, did the court enter an order directing you to pay child support?
At that time, yes.
Okay.
And I could have overturned it if I had money to do that. And do I have any, like, is there anything that I can do at this point? And
no.
My son is 26 years old now.
Well, without looking at the documents, I can't give you a specific answer to that. But what you would look to is how long a period of time transpired from the date of the order until it was sought to be enforced. Perhaps there's a latches or he waited too long argument. That would be one thing to look at. I can't tell you if it would apply or not. But generally speaking, when a court orders you to do something, if you don't do what you're ordered to do, there's going to be a negative consequence. And so if you were ordered to pay child support and you didn't pay it, I don't know that it's a big surprise that he's coming after you for that, right? I mean, what did you expect?
Well, he was paying me and he wanted to get out of it. And he didn't even let me see my son. He didn't even work together with me. And then it's like, here, pay the money. He turned my son against me, and I don't even have a relationship because of him. And then here I'm giving money towards a son that I didn't even get to see a lot as he was growing up. And he was a drug addict, his father, and turned him against me. And it feels like it's cards that I was dealt a bad hand from him, and now it seems very unfair. And I'm just trying to speak out how I can. Is there anything I can do?
What I would say is it's a story of you need to take action at the appropriate time. You need to, at the time the child support was entered, you need to do something at that time. You don't wait years until the kid is 26. So that tells me he's been an adult since he was 18, right? So it's like 8 years.
He didn't do anything either. So it's like, why did he wait so long? And the other thing is, when my son was 13, his dad was incarcerated and in jail, so he did abandon him at that time. So is there any legality that I have?
Well, when he abandoned the child, did you take the child in?
Well, I told him, I didn't know, but he went to California without my approval. So if that went in front of the judge and I knew he was going to California, I would have said, I want you to stay here. I can take care of you.
Okay, so
There's
all kinds of things you could have done at that time. In fact, now we have something called a relocation statute, which if you want to leave the state with a child, you have to seek permission first or that child's getting brought right back. So a lot of the things you're suffering from are from actions that were either taken or not taken, choices that were made that lead you to where you are. And at this point, all I can tell you is go to see a lawyer that can take a look at it for you.
But it'd be important for her to have all that documentation with her, because Denise, I think a lawyer will have to see the order that was entered requiring you to pay child support, and then they also need to see what action your ex is taking now. So I encourage you to gather all that paperwork and consult with a family law attorney that can guide you through that after they have an opportunity to review all the paperwork.
Okay. Now, have you ever seen this ever where is there any laws that could help me in this situation?
Every case is different, and so there's no way we can tell you that there's this one law or this one case that is the sole answer to your question. That's why it's important to gather all those documentation and to consult with an attorney that has all that information so better legal advice can be provided. But we appreciate you listening, and we appreciate you calling tonight.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate all your answers that you gave me.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you, Denise.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, Patrick, she was talking about child support, and I know that's one of the issues that many people have when they're talking about a divorce. How is child support calculated?
Okay, so we have a statute, Florida 61, that determines child support based on, first and foremost, the party's incomes. The deductions from income that are important are health insurance, taxes, obviously. And a big component is the number of overnights. So the number of overnights will determine, be a big factor in determining how much a person pays. Sometimes what we find is people are motivated by child support to get 50-50 timeshare.
That's insane.
Because the more timesharing they get, the less child support they pay. But it's a fairly straightforward calculation. If you have the number of overnights, if you have the incomes of the parties, you can do a pretty good job of figuring out child support. And it is a problem that, you know, her story is not isolated. I mean, there's a lot of people that have been ordered to pay child support that just don't do it. And then they find, hey, they're coming after me for a bunch of money. Well, that's what happens. And again, I come back to, you got to follow court orders.
Right.
If you don't follow, I mean, our whole life, yours and mine, is based upon when judges tell us something, we do it.
Right.
We advise our clients to do it. And it's a very risky thing to go through life having not abided by a court order, which unfortunately I think is what Denise may have done here.
Right. And even in my situation, in my workers' comp cases, oftentimes when we reach a settlement in a workers' comp case, they always inquire whether or not there's back child support. Because in Florida workers' comp cases, the claimant is required to pay at least half of any net settlement that they get in a workers' comp case to pay back child support. And some of my clients are like, oh, well, I didn't know that, you know. And so half of their settlement has to go to pay back child support.
Let me just add one thing to this. Many times I'll get a call from a person who'll say, well, we've got everything settled, and my husband doesn't want to pay child support, and I don't really want it, so we just want to agree not to pay child support. And I have to stop them and say what I've heard judges say and know what the law is, which is that the right to receive child support does not belong to the parent. It belongs to the child. So what you have to do in those instances is you have to have your clients fill out accurately their financial affidavits. You have to actually perform a child support guidelines calculation, and then you see how much to be paid. Under the existing statutes, there are some recognized basis for which you can deviate from child support, but the court has to find them, make findings about them. For example, extraordinary medical expenses. I have a client now who has a child in counseling, and counseling is an extraordinary medical expense for which he can get some relief from his child support obligation for.
Okay.
So there are some little issues like that.
But the parents can't just make agreement on their own, because it's not...
Well, you're not supposed to. Now, I've seen some final judgments that seem that people got away with that, but it's not consistent with the law.
Yeah, and the child support, that can be modified, right?
Yes, right. So when you have an agreement, which is encouraged, the parts of the agreement that deal with property, such as you're dividing your pension, your retirement, you're selling your home, you're allocating your cars, the property aspects are not modifiable. You make a deal on property, that's a deal you're going to make. Now, that's not the same as support or child issues. So a parenting plan, which we discussed earlier, can be modified upon a showing of a substantial change in circumstance that affects the well-being of the child. So you can modify a parenting plan. You can further modify child support upon a showing of a changed circumstance. An example of which would be, an extreme example would be if someone won the lottery. They'll, you know, you get a bunch more money, you get a higher paying job. That can be something that will cause your child support to go up. So, you know, a lot of people, they get this high-paying job, they start driving around in a nice car, living in a nice house. Next thing is their ex-spouse is going to take them for an increase in child support.
Right.
You can guess that.
And would that new law with the presumption of 50-50 time-sharing, if that can be modified, if they're not getting 50-50 right now, correct?
Right. I mean, you can modify a parenting plan based on what's going on with the child. So, for example, you agreed to 50-50 time-sharing. But when the child is in one of the parents' home, they're not doing their homework. They're not signing off on completing assignments, and the child's grades are dipping. That would be an area where a parent could, now we try not to encourage litigation, but it's something to be addressed that could be addressed in litigation, such as, hey, that's a substantial change. We agreed to equal time sharing, but that assumed that this child's going to do well in school, and this child is not doing well in school, so we need to change that.
And we have a few minutes left on this hour, believe it or not. It's almost been an hour. But the law changed last year as well, having to do with alimony.
It did. So alimony is when you have typically a longer-term marriage. It, you know, long-term marriages, under the new statute, is 20 years or greater. But, you know, when you can see marriage as sort of a partnership. And in many of these partnerships, more traditional marriages, say the husband made the money and the mom stayed home and raised the kids. Well, after 20 years, mom hasn't worked, dad's been progressing in his job. It's not fair at divorce for them just to go their separate ways, because the mom is not going to be able to acquire, you know, the same level of income as the dad. So that's the concept of alimony. It's actually a concept we took from England back when women didn't have rights, and you couldn't just divorce your wife, just like you couldn't take a piece of property, like an animal, and just leave it in a field. You had to take care of it. You had to take care of your property. You had to take care of your wife, and that's where, believe it or not, where alimony comes from. Now we have a much different situation than we had in medieval England. We have a situation where married couples very often are both working, which causes its own stress, but it's not quite the disparity. When we're looking at alimony, we're looking at a disparity or a difference in the two incomes. And what the Florida legislature has recently passed was basically a way of looking at how we deal with that disparity. How do we make it more fair? And also, how do we make it more uniform throughout the state of Florida? So you might imagine in Miami they do it one way, in Pensacola they do it one way. It's not, everyone's not applying the alimony rules the same. So when you have some uniformity of statute, you get to the point where you hope to be able to help people. So basically what it is now we look at the need of the person seeking alimony, typically the wife, but not always. And that's determined by their financial affidavit, a deficit. And you look at that number, and then you look at the difference between the two incomes of the husband and wife, their net incomes. And what you get in alimony now is only durational alimony. Permanent alimony, which was in existence up to last year, no longer exists for cases going forward. It's always durational alimony.
Right.
And it's the difference between I know we're going to hear the music, it's time to go, but I'll just add this. You either get the need of the wife, or you get 35% of the difference between the net incomes of the two.
So if people had questions after this, how can they reach you?
Well, I have a presence on the internet, Peacock, Gaffney, and Damanakis, and the phone number is 727-796-7774. You can look me up, just Google me, and you can find me.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Gaffney. I really appreciate you taking the time.
It's been my privilege.
All right. And listeners, thank you for listening. As I always say, drive safely and watch out for those who don't. We'll talk to you next week. Good night.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3.
Listen. More testimony today in Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York.
It's a disaster. This whole case is just a disaster.
Adult star Stormy Daniels taking the stand on what led to her hush money payment ahead of the 2016 election. Our Katrina Kaufman has details.
She told us every detail about the time they spent together in the suite, down to the golden manicure kit that she found in the bathroom. But it's when she actually came out of using that restroom that she found Trump in the bedroom in his boxers, which led to the sexual encounter between the two of them.
Daniels will be back for more testimony on Thursday. Meantime, the federal judge presiding over Trump's classified documents case has indefinitely postponed that trial. CBS's Allison Keyes.
This greatly reduces the chances that he will face a jury in either of the two federal cases against him before the November 5th election.
Prosecutors are also waiting on a Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity.
Free Palestine!
War protests are getting bigger on college campuses. This one at the University of Oregon today, where administrators are now threatening to revoke academic amnesty to students. It comes as Israel invades Rafah.
The National Security Council's John Kirby said the Israelis have indicated this is not a major offensive.
What we've been told by our Israeli counterparts is that this operation last night was limited and designed to cut off Hamas's ability to smuggle weapons and funds into Gaza.
And he says Israel has committed to reopening border crossings to allow in humanitarian aid.
That's CBS's Cammie McCormick reporting. TikTok is suing the U.S. for violating the First Amendment with a new law banning the app if it doesn't divest from China. Tech expert Ian Schur.
The key question here is where the First Amendment runs up against concerns about national security.
That law gives TikTok a year to sell. Investigators in Maryland confirmed today another body has been recovered in Baltimore. Six people died while working on the Key Bridge when it collapsed in March. Crews are now setting up explosives to separate parts of the bridge from the cargo ship that caused the crash. And the United Launch Alliance says engineers have now fixed a valve issue that forced it to scrub its Boeing Starliner launch last night. Space consultant Bill Harwood.
They're trying to analyze data from the rocket to see if the valve did an open and close cycle while it was kind of fluttering, trying to seat itself.